instrument currency, the FAA minimums versus reality. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest today is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, which is published on the internet, also of Bob Miller Flight Training Incorporated. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, as always, Paul.
How is your little airport doing?
Well, we have been challenged beyond belief. This has been one of the most bad winters, I guess is the best way to say it, in terms of just constant repeated snowfalls. And our runway crew's been out there all day today and most of the early morning trying to keep us open. But this particular snowfall came a little bit worse than forecast, and so it shuts us down. It shuts us down operationally, but we try to keep students coming in for ground training and using this weather experience as a learning platform to prepare them for what waits them. We do have operations going on just as soon as the visibility picks up. We get our students out, we get the local pilots out, and they're flying on slippery, snow-covered runways. And it's a challenge, but best they do it in the learning environment, in a teaching environment, than try to negotiate some of this the first time on their own.
Bob, let's start out today talking about a safety topic that you are on fairly frequently, and that is the real needs that proficiency dictates versus the legal definition of current. In the current edition of Over the Airwaves, you have an article entitled, "So You Think Your Instrument Current." Yeah, right. Tell us about the incident that inspired this article.
Well, like so many IFR accidents, it involved this particular one that we referenced occurred back in Warrenton, Virginia last year, involving a V-tail Bonanza and an instrument-rated pilot who was attempting to shoot an approach to very low minimums and lost it on the final approach with fatal consequences. And the NTSB probable cause report said it was due to the pilot's failure to follow published instrument approach procedures and his failure to maintain minimum descent altitude, which resulted in a collision with trees and terrain. Contributing to the accident were the night conditions, instrument meteorological conditions. And when we went back and looked at the pilot's own history, he had a fair amount of time as a pilot, but in the last 5 months, he had an IPC 5 months earlier and no IFR time recorded in actual conditions in the previous 5 months, and found himself out attempting an IFR approach to minimums. And per FAR 6157, the recency requirement for IFR flight, he was perfectly legal. And if you looked at him against the FARs, there was nothing to suggest that he lacked the proficiency necessary to successfully execute this approach. But he didn't. And that's why I'm saying that there is a big difference, and I think most of us realize this, between what is legal and what is proficient. And if that difference is too great, then we find ourselves on the short end of the operational stick, so to speak.
Well, I know what your answer is going to be to this next question, and that is, if that's not enough to keep us truly proficient, why is the bar not set higher in regulatory?
Yeah, that's a politically hot question right there. We have organizations, specifically AOPA, for example, and EAA is another good example, who are both membership organizations and endeavor to support the interests of their members. And in so doing, they want to lessen the burdens as much as possible to access to the airways. And sometimes if a training burden is, a training requirement is seen as burden, too much of a burden, they will lobby, aggressively to minimize, that training requirement if we cannot prove efficacy, for example. If we were to say, for example, we ought to be a requirement to shoot approaches every 3 months as opposed to every 6 months, organizations such as AOPA would say, well, that by necessity would, by definition, would represent a burden to our pilots. And unless we can prove that would actually result in improved proficiency, let's not do it. Well, you know, I would make an argument that on an empiric basis, that more frequently we train, the more proficient we will become. So there is the trade-off. And the trade-off is, the regulations are kept at a minimum level, certainly in the Part 91 environment, And my argument is, and I think to AOPA's credit, is, listen, the burden should be on the pilot to determine for himself or herself what his own level of proficiency should be, and then they should train to that level. But unfortunately, we don't, as we see in this particular example. And then we have another problem. We have flight schools that believe very strongly in the use of flight simulators, mm-hmm. desktop PC simulators, and as a way of maintaining proficiency. And I'm here to tell you, and I'll go on record with anybody, saying they don't work. They do work in terms of teaching procedures,
mm-hmm.
but they simply do not replicate the what's going on here at our local airport this afternoon when visibility's down to a half a mile and blowing snow. And, well, my critics would say, well, you know, the GA pilot has no business flying in that environment. Well, yes, but we find ourselves in that environment, and if we're there, we better be far more proficient than our last ride on a PC simulator.
Well, and as you pointed out in the past, if you're not instrument proficient in your area, you're writing off, you know, a third or a half the year.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to use our airplanes in this part of the country, we have to have that level of proficiency, no doubt about it, or we will be on the ground.
Well, Bob, when we come back from the break, let's talk about a few things that we should be doing to make sure that we are proficient in finding out what that minimum currency level for us needs to be, regardless of what the regulations said as a minimum. Bob Miller is my guest. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend. But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot. We're talking about instrument proficiency and having a discussion really that impacts proficiency in all areas, not just in instrument. Bob, if the regulations set the bar too low for us to truly be safe, or as safe as we ever can be in a three-dimensional travel medium, how do we determine what it takes for us personally to be ready to fly on days when things are marginal?
Very good question. What we need to do is to take a competent flight instructor in the right seat, we in the left seat, and go out and shoot approaches in challenging weather. Shoot approaches to IFR minimums. We get a number of requests as a result of Over the Airwaves to do accelerated instrument training. And more often than not, an individual will call us from a different location in the country and say, you know, Bob, we'd like to avail ourselves to your training, but we want to be assured that we're going to be able to have actual IFR conditions. Well, obviously, we cannot make that guarantee, but the probability is quite high that sometime between November and April, we will have IFR conditions for their training.
Mm-hmm.
But to the credit of the caller, the callers, these are individuals who say, I recognize that getting an instrument rating is one thing, but doing it in actual instrument conditions is an entirely different story altogether. So to answer your question, the only way to gain proficiency is to get in the airplane and in instrument conditions. And do our friends in the South, they can do it too. They just have to get on an airplane or bring their airplane up into the northern climates, schedule their training in the wintertime, and take training, not just from us, but any flight school in the northern reaches of the United States. I'm sure there are many that would be more than delighted to provide instrument training experience in real IFR conditions. That's the answer to that question.
All right. What about setting an amount? Is there any way you can set personal minimums in terms of I will not go up unless I've had this many approaches in the last however many months? I mean, how do you plug the numbers into that puzzle?
That's a tougher question. You know, we like to say we train to proficiency rather than in any hour requirement. I know myself, there are times when I'll go 2 weeks maybe and not be on an instrument approach down low to the ground. And if it's more than a couple of weeks, I'll tell you, I get sweaty palms. I can feel that I've lost that sharp edge that I have when I do them, you know, two or three times a week. These skills are extremely fragile. And if they're not exercised every couple of weeks, then we need to get back in the airplane and do it every couple of weeks. Or, and this sounds rather harsh, take a black magic marker, pull out our certificate, and black out the word instrument on the back of our certificate. We ought not be flying in instrument conditions unless we have that level of proficiency. And that's not Bob Miller. Just look at the accident data. The most frequent weather-related accident, of course, is of continued VFR flight into IMC conditions. And when you look at the data, the accidents happen equally to IFR-rated pilots as well as VFR-only pilots. So it is a significant problem. And until we as a group of pilots recognize this and take it upon ourselves to improve our proficiency through additional training, or we leave it up to the FAA to start mandating tighter requirements. Our choice.
All right. The National Transportation Safety Board's summary said contributing to the accident were the night instrument meteorological conditions. How big a part does night play in this? Are there people who are proficient to fly IFR approaches in the daytime who still shouldn't be out at night?
I don't think there's any difference if we're truly in instrument meteorological conditions. If we can't see out the window, then we can't see out the window. The only challenge might be lighting in the cockpit. If we have inadequate lighting in the cockpit and cannot read our approach plates, for example, but that's only for a brief couple of minutes to brief the plate. Then it's committed to memory and we're on the gauges, and the gauges, of course, need to be lighted. So whether I'm doing it at night or in the daytime, I think there's no difference. Again, if we're talking about true instrument meteorological conditions.
I think I know the answer to this question, too, but which would you rather be behind in this situation if it's nighttime? A six-pack, you know, the associated radio navigation equipment, or a G1000?
Okay, that's, an excellent question. If you're proficient on the gauges, you can do it with the six-pack just as easily as you can do it on the G1000 glass cockpit. I think if you're less than proficient and you're not flying as frequently or you're not shooting approaches as frequently, I believe that it's far easier to shoot an approach using the glass cockpit. My goodness, you have an 8-inch by 8-inch screen on the right, the multifunction display that's showing your airplane as it comes down the final approach course. And then you have an equally large screen directly in front of you in the primary flight display that shows a huge horizon, blue sky, and brown ground. So if I'm not very proficient, I haven't flown approaches to minimums in several weeks, I'd much rather do it on the glass. But if I'm doing it every day, and I'll talk to busy pilots who are out there in older airplanes, check haulers and guys operating under Part 135, they'll tell you, hey, just give me an attitude indicator and an HSI and an altimeter and an airspeed indicator, I can do it just fine.
All right, before we leave, Bob, what's this seminar that's going on at your little airport tonight?
Well, we've got a talented A&P here and a group of interested pilots who, you know, like to work on the airplanes and do a lot of experimental home building. And I think sometimes we all lose sight of the fact of the required paperwork by the FAA. And those of us that operate, production airplanes, we too lose sight of what paperwork is required to keep us legal. Do we have the required 337s? If a modification has been made, is the paperwork in order? Things like the registration and airworthiness certificate, is that in proper order? The POH, do we have all of the latest updates for the pilot's operating handbook? If not, the airplane is not airworthy. If the airplane is not airworthy, then we have a question as to whether or not the insurance company will pay if there is a mishap. So we're just going to have several hours where we're inviting in as many pilots that can attend. We'll have a representative from the FAA here, and we're just going to go over the paperwork required to maintain our aircraft in a paperwork legal status.
Is RSVP required, or if somebody's hearing this and is a couple exits down the throughway, can they just stop by?
No, they can jump in. We've asked people to register on the FAA.gov. They can get wings credit if they go through. I think they can get wings credit even if they show up. But that was a convenient way for us to get the word out. And no, people are invited. Stop in.
If they need directions to BQR, where can they find them?
Go on AirNav if they're going to fly in. We're just 6 miles southeast of the Buffalo International Airport, 4343 Walden Avenue. Or just look up on any OTA issue, overtheairwaves.com. In the current issue, we have information there as to how to get here.
All right, Bob. Well, I know that you're looking out the window waiting out some snow now. I hope you have a productive week, and we'll talk to you again next Monday.
Thanks again, Paul.
You can read the current edition of Over the Airwaves and find out more about Bob Miller Flight Training Incorporated at www.overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from AeroNews. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.